Wir gerne sehen, was ist los? It's deinen Freundo, Seth. I'm learning German. Yeah, in case you didn't know what that was. That is me trying to impress you with the little German that I know. Right now, I am actually learning German. I took it in high school. I goofed off the entire time. I did some other language learning apps. They taught me things like where the taxi stand is and how to find a bus, but not a lot of conversational German. Thankfully, that's what Babbel is all about. Babbel teaches you language conversationally, which, let's face it, that is what you want to know anyway. I don't know. When I was in school, you learned like how to count. You learned like the colors. You learned the shapes. Those are all important things, but they don't help you when you're in like Cologne, Germany with Ein Nierenstein, which, by the way, is German for kidney stone, an experience I can unfortunately speak personally to. But I've been using Babbel to learn to speak German again, better than I have before. I actually really like it because it is conversational. It's a little bit more relaxed. One of the things that it does that I really like is it'll sometimes show you what the literal English translation is. And I don't know why, but I find that very helpful in sort of understanding the structure, the grammar of a language and sort of putting myself into that mind space. Since I'm only in Germany for Gamescom, which is like a week, week and a half, I'm not immersed in the German language. I'm not immersed in German culture. So what I do is the second best thing. I'm taking Babbel. Hopefully this year when I go to Germany, I'll be able to impress all the Germans with how much German I know from learning through Babbel. The app has pronunciation recognition, so you'll be able to learn how to speak better with your accent, how to actually properly pronounce the words. That way you won't get made fun of by a group of older German men because you said Apfelstrudel and not Apfelstrudel. No, it's really cool. I'm going to say right now there is a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now you can get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners, because you guys are the best ones, by the way, at babbel.com/realm. Get 60% off at babbel.com/realm. That is spelled babbel.com/realm. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk turned traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world. That ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
Listen!
Welcome to Nintendo Voice Chat, IGN's Nintendo podcast. My name is Philip Musin, and today I'm joined by Per Schneider,
hey.
Brian Altano,
hey.
And Brian Jorgensen.
So close!
Hi, everyone.
Here it is.
Take 24.
Jorgensen.
Sigurgesson.
Sigurgesson.
Yes.
How different. Yeah.
Hey, though, Brian Sigurgesson.
Yeah.
If
we made it through.
If you're listening and you don't see like a lower third popped up, your name is spelled, and I'm not making fun of you. I'm just actually explaining how terrible we are at saying this. Brjann. So you and I have the same first name, but yours is adventurous.
Right. And you started misspelling it a thousand years ago.
And your last name is Sigurgersson.
Yeah.
I can't believe we screwed that up.
The son of Sigurd.
It's awesome.
More importantly.
It really is that. It is the son of Sigurd. So my dad's first name is Sigurd.
Oh, okay.
Oh, cool.
You've insulted the out of my dad. Thank you.
Like a thousand Thor curses on you.
Welcome to NPC, everyone.
Welcome to NPC, yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Pleasure to have you here, Brian. No, honestly, well, if you don't know, Brian is actually the CEO and responsible for some of the greatest indie games ever to release on Nintendo consoles, in my opinion, the SteamWorld series, in particular SteamWorld Dig 2, which was a massive hit, not only in this office, but for Switch fans and, you know, just gamers alike. So thank you very much for joining us here.
It's a complete pleasure. Right?
Yeah.
It's fantastic to be here.
Absolutely. Cool. So, yeah, I mean, I'd just love to ask you some questions, pick your brain about, you know, SteamWorld and the development process and just a little bit more about Imogen Form as well.
Go ahead. And I should say first, it wasn't me that nicked a few of your amiibos there, Pear. It wasn't me. They're not in my back.
We talked about this. You can't touch.
I did notice that collection go from 600 down to 500.
Oh, God. Yeah, he went to the bathroom. And yep. What's missing? Detective Pikachu!
So Brian, we'd love to know, like, what is it like to work with Nintendo and getting a game actually on the eShop? What's that experience like for a developer?
It can be everything. I mean, like when we put out SteamWorld Dig in the first game, it was terrifying because the game had to sort of slide through lot check on the first try. If it didn't do that, lot check is the approval process. Nintendo.
And does that mean they're playing it and they're like, it's great or
no bugs,
broken? Or because, I mean, isn't that kind of on you guys before it even gets to them?
Yeah, but it's kind of hard, you know. It's like, there can be bugs in places where you're not thinking about looking. So with the first game, SteamWorld Dig, it really had to go through on the first try because we were totally out of money. And everyone had gone on vacation. So if there had been like a rejection email, there would have been no one to answer that.
Oh, no.
Were they
thinking like, we got to go on vacation because this company's not going to be here when we get back?
Or maybe I sent everyone on vacation.
Oh.
No, but it's...
furlough.
The thing is, like, Sweden stops in July. So we wrapped up
development. It gets so hot, right? Like about 15 degrees. And so you guys got to take time off.
Yeah, people are like passing out in the street and stuff. So, no, but at the end of June, like Sweden kind of, goes on vacation. Mm-hmm. It's not operating. So, like, for 4 weeks, everyone is just off.
You guys get a four-week vacation?
We get 5 weeks, actually.
How do you make video games? That's amazing.
Well, it rains the rest of the year. So
you stay in programming.
Okay. Got it. Yeah. Yeah. So there's, like, about 2 days of nice weather. They're always in July. So you have to sort of be off then. And then when we got back... to our relief, we had passed through lot check.
But it was not, I mean, there's sometimes indie studios that kind of live by the day. And so a delay by 2 months or something can be really, can be really difficult. Like some companies can't recover from that.
No,
right?
Exactly. I mean, also, I mean, we're not a AAA studio. I mean, I don't know what the term is these days. Is it triple I for a studio like us?
Big indie?
Triple I? That's good.
Did you hear that? Yeah, okay. Yeah. So that's sort of...
You guys...
It doesn't really matter.
Telltale, I guess?
Yeah.
But the thing is that we have... we can't really come out with a game, say, in November. Mm-hmm. Like, if we miss... if we plan for the game to be out in August or September and we're not done, it's disastrous because we sort of have to wait until maybe... February to put that game out because there's just so much noise going on
in
the last months of the year.
And so specifically, I mean, with SteamWorld Dig 2, which launched recently, which we adored, you know, we could not stop telling our audience how great this game is. I genuinely love it. I 100%ed it. Even all the incredibly difficult stuff at the end, I was actually cursing on an airplane playing.
It's the first game I recommend to anybody who says, I want to download a game from the eShop. I'm always like, this is the
same
one.
Did you guys have a release date planned?
We did.
And then did you get it?
No. It was, we don't like go for a specific date, but I'm really adamant. Always I go in and say, okay, this game is coming out in August. There is no two ways about it.
Right.
And then it came out September 21st. So it's not bad.
And so your SteamWorld Dig is for those of you who haven't played it, you should please go fix that right now. Your Switch can download games as you listen to this show. It's a Metroidvania.
Yeah.
And you guys launched within 2 weeks of a new Metroid from Nintendo.
I know.
So, I mean, that came to 3DS and this came to Switch. So I don't know if that was just happenstance, if that was sort of a magical, wonderful surprise that dawned on you guys or...
It was a surprise. Let's put it that way. It was happy. And I mean, we... it seems to always go that way. I mean, when we released... perhaps our best game ever called Antil, which is an iOS game that neither of you has played. It's a fantastic game. It came out in 2011 on the day that Steve Jobs died.
Oh.
So we come with the game and it's like, and all the Apple media is of course full of the other news, right?
Right. Yeah.
And SteamWorld Dig is the lucky exception because that's like Nintendo really came through for us and made it into a fantastic launch. SteamWorld Heist, we did everything everything happened too. I mean, just before we came out, Codename Steam came out.
Oh, right.
And I didn't
turn-based.
See that game.
Oh, exactly. My God.
I didn't see that game first. I just read about it. It's like, okay, it's turn-based. It's, okay, guys, maybe there are other jobs that you can get. And then, like, with SteamWorld Dig 2, as you say, right, it's, Metroidvania comes out sort of right at the same time as perhaps, like, yeah, well, the Metroid game.
Yeah, the Metroid herself.
Right, exactly. So, yeah. We were worried.
That's scary.
Yeah.
But at least, I mean, this was kind of like the Metroid game you wanted to get on the Switch, right?
Right.
So there was good news around that you had to go back to the 3DS to play Metroid. And so maybe that worked out well game and people were interested. But I mean, calling it a Metroidvania is also kind of discounting that this game is very different, right?
Yeah.
Like Metroid is like, there's a tunnel there. Hidden paths. There are no hidden paths here. It's like you dig your way through. You create tunnels and kind of like in like games like Dig Dug, like a rock can fall on your head. So it's a very different game too.
Yeah, it's a fair game. Let's put it that way.
It's fair.
Yeah.
And so just kind of to add on to Philip's question, like when you're developing a game for Steam, you know, I assume there are fewer restrictions. Like it's a little easier to get the game into the shop. Like how hard is it to get something through to the end with a Nintendo console?
Yeah, I mean, if you can bear with me a minute, I'll tell you about it. Like, so, I mean, the first time we got a game out on a Nintendo console was SteamWorld Tower Defense, game that nobody has played, right? It came out in 2010, and now you can only download it on Nintendo 3DS. I think it's $5.
Oh.
Get it? It's a very, very simple effort. But we never met anyone at Nintendo for that reason. We sort of just sent builds to them. We didn't even know who we were talking to, really, on the other end.
But you did have a dev kit and everything, right?
Yeah, we did, yeah.
So to get that, you were sort of like, we want to make Nintendo games?
Yeah, and then that's it. Yeah, exactly. It's also a long time ago, so I can't really remember. But somehow we stole it from somewhere and then made the game. But it's so we made that game. But like the first real deal was with SteamWorld Dig, where we had made that game for a few months, and we were starting to go broke. And I met with Nintendo here at GDC.
Mm-hmm. The game developers.
Yeah, in 2013, in San Francisco. And when they started playing it on the 3DS, I realized that we haven't sent them any builds. We haven't shown them anything of this game before. Suddenly, I just go cold inside. I said, what if they... How does this work, even? Like, a thousand thoughts, right? It was like, can they just say, it's like, what is this? This isn't what I thought it was going to be.
We don't like digging.
No, exactly. And just toss it out, right?
Right.
Or just tell us on the spot or send us a polite email afterwards. Like, not really what we're looking for.
Yeah.
And like, we're sort of investing all of this money without researching that properly first. Very, very clever, it turned out, because... No, it was very dumb, of course.
Yeah. but it seems like it was a pretty smooth sailing since then. And now, obviously, you've made a splash.
Yep.
Dig 2 is one of the top-selling games on the eShop. I assume with your follow-up, you're pretty confident that it'll be an easy process.
Yeah.
Which, of course, you'll announce the game today here on the show.
Or you're talking about that follow-up. Yeah. Follow, I see.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
we're playing. Pear's playing the long game.
Suddenly, I don't dare to say anything because I'll just say the wrong.
Yeah,
thing.
No, but the other thing, the other thing that struck me is like as a indie, you have the choice whether you put something on Steam first and maybe even try it in early access while you're still bug testing and stuff, or you can decide to put it on the Switch. Like, what drove the decision to put it like first on the Switch?
It's the relation to Nintendo, basically. I mean. If you put it in perspective, like in 2013, let's say in July in 2013, nobody had heard about Image and Form. And Nintendo decided to put us in a Nintendo Direct with this game that they didn't know if it was going to fly.
Yeah.
It was just that a few people at Nintendo liked the game and sort of championed it for us. And it was really brave of them to do that. And so yeah, it was. It's an easy decision for us to. We happily call ourselves an indie.
Right.
We're proud to say that.
No, I love that.
And also, I mean, we we really enjoy being compared to Nintendo because, and I of course, I'm not saying that we're as good as Nintendo, but that's where we want to set the bar. We want people to talk about our games, not like it's a really good game for being an indie.
Yeah. There's always that. We get that a lot with our audience. We do it ourselves sometimes too, right? It's sort of like a handicap.
Where
people are just like, yeah, he's really great, you know. But it's like for two people making a game, this is pretty good for that.
Yeah.
It's like, no, it's a good game. Period.
Exactly.
Like, that's just compare it to other good games or great games. Like, and it's hard to do that. And I think with Nintendo coming out with something like their Nindies presentation, that's a pretty damn awesome like kind of cosign for them to be like, hey, these are our friends. Like, they're gonna hang out. We're working on Mario's and Zelda's Splatoons and stuff like that, but in the meantime we got this stuff, and it's them sort of giving you guys like this like push out, and I really respect that they handle it that
way. So that's great. So you have a good relationship, so we're not going to go to E3 and Xbox conference, here comes Brian, and it's like, we proudly announced SteamWorld Battle Royale exclusively on Xbox One.
You're just trying to make me say things, aren't you?
No, totally not.
No, but it's but yeah, I mean, it's also personal. The people that work in Nintendo, I think they enjoy working at Nintendo. So you sort of form a long personal relationship, and they're really fine people. Let's put it that way. So we're really happy to work with them.
Well, I'd love to know, like, you know, the SteamWorld series and the whole franchise itself is very varied in different types of game types. You know, like Dig is obviously a Metroidvania style game, and Heist is more of like a, turn-based style game. What kind of games did you play growing up? Like, what were your favorite games growing up?
Right. Well, it's like I'm probably old enough to be your grandfather. It's like you wouldn't believe that.
I don't know.
Pear's grandfather, maybe.
It's Philip's trick. He's actually twice our age.
I'm actually older.
Oh, really?
I'm actually older than Pear. Yeah.
Well, so I grew up playing. I grew up playing arcade games. And you know, that meant that what do you call it? Like games that sort of were at hand, kind of limited, right? You would be playing what games were on display in that cafeteria next to the school where the kids weren't supposed to go.
Mm-hmm.
And there I played Dig Dug for the first time, for example.
Yeah.
And all those old games, like Tetris was played that there for the first time too, I think. And I enjoyed it. And the thing I enjoyed about playing arcade games was that like every game session counted. It counted.
It
cost this much, right?
Which was $100 when you were that age.
Exactly.
A quarter was like the most. Yeah, that was like cigarettes in prison.
Yeah.
It's like this is big. Right. This is a big deal.
Yeah, it was.
I have to kill a guy for this.
Yeah, and so you sat there. It's like, are my hands sweating? It's like it was for real. Really, you sit there and it's like, oh, I have to do better than last time. And it was magical too, because it was made by gods. Like these games. That you could actually make games, you know? Who makes these things?
Yeah.
It's impossibly great, all of these games. And they were so varied, too. Like, so many, I mean, all the ideas come sort of from that time. Like, these classical games are born at that time. And I'm standing playing them, and I'm not realizing that I'm playing games that are, it's sort of like history in the making as I play it. So that was fantastic. I grew up playing that.
Obviously, I mean, you mentioned Dig Dug right away. That's a game where you dig in the earth and rocks go shaky, shaky, shaky and fall on your head or on a dragon, right?
Right.
Yeah. Sick.
So completely stolen comps.
No, like Boulder Dash is another game that I played on computers growing up, you know, where I kind of see the connection, but it's really interesting to hear you mention Dig Dug.
I think the arcades were really awesome because, and you kind of get it with esports now, it was just this thing that was bigger than you physically.
Yeah.
Like as a small child, you walk up to this thing that was the size of an upright car that had Donkey Kong on it.
Yeah.
And put money into it, and all of a sudden this screen showed you personally a thing that you could control.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I was like, that's so cool to be able to see that and then start being like, who's in there?
Yeah.
Like, what's inside this thing? Who made this?
Yeah. It was impossibly great.
Mm-hmm.
This, how can you capture a person like that? Mm-hmm. Like, you stand there as, your hands are sweating because it's so important, right? Mm-hmm. This session that you're going to have in this game. And then later I got, like, as a contrast, for some birthday, I got, like in the early 80s, I got a Game & Watch, the Nintendo. I got the Turtle Beach one.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Now a famous headphone brand.
Yeah, exactly. Sold out.
Not the same.
And then another one from a competitor, Gakken or something. And
yeah.
It was completely amazing. I was amazed by these things. I would just sit with them all the time and play, like, on the bus on the way to school and on the bus on the way home.
So that was your introduction to handhelds, basically.
Yeah.
And also the first time Nintendo introduced a dual screen display of it.
With the Donkey Kong, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Which is what you guys eventually went to develop for on 3DS.
Yeah. So, I mean, that experience is like to be able for us to give that. That's why I think that it's. Like, if you make a game, you have a big responsibility. Mm-hmm. Like, if you make something that is bad or, like, not optimized, you're sort of wasting someone's magical moment, if you understand what I mean. Like, you sit there and say, okay, I heard this is going to be great. And then if it's not, then it's terrible, right?
So how do you – I think that's interesting. How do you feel when you have a game – I mean, I can – objectively say I feel SteamWorld Dig 2 is a much better game than the first one, right? Like when I play the game, like, how do you feel about that? Like, do you have regrets when you look at the original? Are you embarrassed? Are you saying, no, this was what we could do with the resources given in at that time and we graduate and, like, no, you know, no regrets, nothing?
Yeah, exactly that. I mean, that's precisely how I feel about SteamWorld Dig. That is what we could manage to do at that time. And when we put that out, I thought it looked marvelous.
Yeah.
I was so proud of SteamWorld Dig, and I'm still very proud of
it's
because
so good.
The ideas are so. I think it really works. And then, like, we make SteamWorld Dig 2, and you compare them, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I was doing a talk here now at GDC about just that, like, how do you make a game better than the original? So it was good because it actually let me visit that, like, to think about how you improve on things.
Yeah.
And we have basically improved on every area from SteamWorld Dig. And I'm happy about that because it means that we're learning. We're actually getting better the whole time.
And so the moment you finish SteamWorld Dig 2, are you starting to think about the next game and, like, here are the elements I wanted to get in and I couldn't? Or do you kind of, like, take time off and you just gotta refresh your batteries and just kind of collect yourself?
Just immediately afterwards, I think it's...
you go on vacation for 5 weeks.
No, but it's... we had... just immediately afterwards, you sit and think and say... Right after the final build is done, you sit there and say, is this really cut off? Like, because there's... Okay.
Get one more thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then, I mean, you would sit like that forever. You would sort of, like, shoehorn in, the stuff... And you would never get done.
Well, you guys committed to finishing the game and then shipping it. That's not actually common anymore. I mean, a lot of games just are this sort of amorphous blob that never end or start. They come out, they're games as a service, they're patch notes on day one and all the stuff.
DLC.
You made the game and put it on the shop and it was like, this is it, it's here, it's done.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you could have half-assed it. A lot of people do.
Yeah. The thing is also, I mean, in the noughties, I like that word, like in the 80s, 90s, and noughties.
Mm-hmm.
So in the noughties, we actually were making edutainment games for kids in a franchise. We made like 25 or 30 games on CD-ROM for PC and Mac.
Mm-hmm.
And that was real sort of when you submit it to the factory that presses up these CDs,
it's done.
It's like you cannot affect it anymore. It's if you have a bug in there or like a serious bug, you have lost so much money doing that.
Right.
Yeah.
And what was it like? Was it Metroid Prime 2 or 3? One of them had like a game breaking glitch in it. And
3, right?
Was it 3? And you could like mail your discs in the Nintendo.
You had to mail your memory card.
Yeah.
And then they would mail your memory card back.
Space Station Silicon Valley, the cartridge for N64 too, had a fatal bug in it.
It seems so foreign and bizarre nowadays.
Yeah.
Your stories of that. But that's really the way it was for a long time.
Yeah. So like games would be perfect when they came, and I don't mean that we're better or anything like anyone else, but for us, we sort of keep that mentality. It's like let's avoid this. Like people don't like to. Here's the game. I downloaded it. I say, okay, it's not working. Oh, but a patch is in the works, right?
Mm-hmm.
really? It's like, why didn't you make the game whole from the beginning? It's like, right. why am I, this is actually broken. Where do I return this?
Yeah. Well, you're competing with so many different games right now, so many different forms of entertainment, your phone, Netflix, everything. And so you might only get that first 5 minutes with a player.
That's it.
And if they're gone, they're gone forever. And actually, they might see your logo for all of history and be like, image and form. Oh, they really hurt. They hurt my feelings that day.
Yeah.
And never come back again.
Right.
Well, you said that initially when SteamWorld Dig 1 launched on 3DS, you were very proud of the way it looked. And rightfully so, I think. But was that the same feeling that you experienced with the launch of SteamWorld Dig 2 on Switch? Or would you say it was similar, bigger, more proud, more excited? Like, what was the team's feeling around the launch of that game? And then the immediate sort of response that you received, you know, through fans and right. reactions like that.
Yeah, I was super proud. I actually, because I knew that the game was very, very good.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say that because it was such a big difference compared to SteamWorld Dig. When we shipped that game or sent it off for approval, we didn't know. We had been so close to the screen for so many months that we had sort of. We were deaf to sort of what it was. Mm-hmm. It's like, is it bad? Is it mediocre? Is it good? Is it great? Or you have people come into the office and play it, and it's like, so what do you think? Mm-hmm. Oh, I think it's good. Mm-hmm. Yeah, are you saying that because you're our friend?
I think there's that thing where it happens with artists and musicians and cooks and stuff like that. They're in the kitchen, right? And they're making stuff for so long. They're the only person that's seen it or tasted it or heard it. And they come up for air and they show it to people and people are like, oh, God, this is awful. But you're like, I love this. This is my jam. And it's like, no, dude, this is really bad.
This is bad jam.
And
it's a bad jam.
Yeah, and I'm glad this didn't happen here. And so how immediately do you guys find out sort of like, what are you tracking sales on the fly? Like, how does that information get kicked to you? Because I know.
How do you know you're successful?
Yeah, how do you know? Do you know within 24 hours, like, we're doing okay? We don't have to shut the factory down or anything?
I'll tell you about that in just a second. But first, I'm just going to say that I have to just do a shout out to the game director who gets way too little recognition. Mm-hmm. It's like I'm always out hogging credit for everything that we do. So the game director for SteamWorld Dig, for SteamWorld Heist, and for SteamWorld Dig 2 is a guy called Olle Håkansson.
Okay,
and
we know how to spell that immediately.
Yeah. Perfect.
Say that again.
Olle Håkansson.
Okay,
he's just a genius, and he's sort of
thanks, Olle.
Yeah, he's sort of the guy that keeps it together because you asked about like what was the feeling about the game.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. He's a really sober guy when it comes to killing darlings. Right, they'll think up darlings or like features in the game,
mm-hmm.
and we have a revision meeting or something like that. And I was like, where's that feature? Yeah, it's on the shit list, right? No, it can't be on the shit list. Yeah, it's not good enough. You know? And so I imagine there's like this list in the bathroom, right? where these features go that don't make it into the game.
Well, you come in with all these ambitions, right? Yeah. And then you're like, oh, we want to have a jetpack, or we want to have like a quadruple jump, or he fights a boss that's like three stories tall.
Right.
And then you look at the clock and you look at the team and they're tired and you're like, no, it's got to go.
Right.
Does that list have a Swedish name?
Sorry?
What's the Swedish name for that list?
Skitlistan.
Skitlistan.
That sounds much better. There's that's
no, I'm using that.
Yeah, well, every developer is going to use that.
Skitlistan, buddy. Brijan.
Brijan.
Mm-hmm. Right. You guys want to start calling me Brijan, I'm cool with it.
Yep.
So, right. But you asked about the how soon do you know
if
it's working or not. The thing is that SteamWorld Dig 2 was the first game that we put out on the Switch.
Mm-hmm.
And so there must have been some glitch sort of in conjunction with that they had just set up our account. Because the first, like, it sort of lags one day. So, like, day one sales, you can sort of find out about that day two.
Oh, man. So that first 24 hours, you're just checking your phone waiting for that email from Nintendo?
No, actually, you go into a site. And
All
right. And
it's self-service.
Yeah, exactly. And I went in after the first day to look at day one sales.
It's zero?
No, it wasn't like, well, I mean, then I would have concluded that, okay, I was a bit early. But like, I gave it enough time and I went in and looked and it's like, huh, great. This is better than SteamWorld Dig, right? The original.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. I'm relieved, right? Okay, good. And also, I mean, like SteamWorld Dig 2 is at regular price, it's $20. The original is $10. So that means like, okay, that's great. So we have more than twice the cash for this. Good, good. People are not getting fired. And then I went in like a day later to check out day two sales. And then the day one sales had updated and were much larger than when I went in the last time, right?
Because you had the full 24 hours.
Yeah. No, it wasn't that.
It wasn't counted yet?
No, it's like, so I'm like, is this strange? And then I go in like a day after that, like a third time, and day one is still updating. And I said, this is amazing. I'm affecting these figures. Whenever I go in, they go up.
So you're like, ding, ding, ding.
Yeah.
I got to check every day.
Yeah, exactly. And it settled after a while, but there was something with populating the sales numbers, probably because it was our first title or for some technical reason. Yeah. So it was goosebumpy. It's like you'd go in there, it's like, what is it going to be?
That sounds so.
You guys pop open the champagne after the first couple of days.
We did. We actually got a bottle of champagne from Famitsu, the Japanese.
Yeah, right.
Nice. Because our score went over a certain threshold.
Oh, that's great.
And so they actually sent us a bottle of champagne and a gold medal.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Didn't
that's
get one cool. from IGN, but
we don't bribe.
Yeah. we have some beer on tap. We can.
Yeah, we'll give you a beer after
the team.
But that's great. So you guys were obviously very happy with the sales. And like, when you look back now, you guys didn't announce like overall sales numbers for the title, did you?
No.
Yeah.
And we're probably not going to.
Oh, really? Okay.
Right.
It's just a competitive secret you don't want to give away to the other guys or?
No, it's could be that. But that's first and foremost, it's like we're Swedish, right? It's like if you know Swedish people, we're so intimidated the whole time. It's like inhibited. If we say something good about ourselves, it's terrible, right? It's like, like you say something and say, yeah, I feel that, like now I can do 30 push-ups, and suddenly they're like, it's like someone stabbing you in the back, right? And it's like that Lutheran sort of bad conscience, like you shall not speak well of yourself.
So you'll wait till some Nintendo earnings report, and then the number is going to show up in there, and
people can find out that way. Yep. But it's like if I'm talking about it, just who is. How are people going to react to that? Like it just, if it's bad, then it's like, oh, I feel sorry for those guys. And if it's good, it's like, yeah, you
better buy beer next time, right? Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, I do have one last question for you before we move on. Who do we have to call to get a SteamWorld Amiibo? Or I'm sorry, SteamWorld Amiibos, yes, and SteamWorld characters in Smash.
Yeah, okay. So, dear people, like, go online and tell Nintendo what you think. I mean, Amiibos, definitely in Smash Brothers and so on. Do it. Just influence them. And,
do it.
Obviously, Amiibos, that's up to us, right? We have to sort of, we can make the decision to do it. And it's just, again, we're sort of concerned about that. So are people going to buy it?
Bug. Yeah. But with the Smash Brothers character, I mean, that's a really good point.
That's Nintendo.
That's like Bug Sakurai.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But because your character has very different mechanics from other, you know, Nintendo's own franchise characters or some of the third-party stuff, like just the, you know, the drill mechanic, the, you know, the kind of the hook shot and the climbing stuff could be really interesting.
Yeah, and the pickaxe, of course, right?
The jetpack.
The jetpack.
Mm-hmm. Spoilers.
Sort of, I don't want... Exactly.
It's been out for a while.
Yeah. Right. No, there are some really cool tools. Yeah. I think it would be Nintendo, that would be a great fit for Smash Brothers.
Yeah. Very, very true.
Make it happen, Brian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all right.
Let's do
Come
it.
Come on, Breon.
It's up Make to it you happen. Guys. Come on, Breon. All the Breons in the world, get together.
Yeah, all right.
Make this happen.
Well, as we had mentioned earlier, the Game Developers Conference, or GDC, is happening this week in San Francisco. And some of us from the office got to go. Brian and I, Brian Altano and I, had a chance to go check out all of the Nindies from the Nintendo Direct Nindie Showcase the other day, and we have some things to tell you guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's go through some quick impressions of all the games we played.
So I saw the presentation, like most people here, I saw the presentation online when they were streaming it. You know, I felt like there were some awesome announcements and some games I obviously really like seeing return. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't like this kind of mind-blown type presentation. It was like, oh, yeah, these are all good-looking games.
Yeah.
Same kind of reaction when you guys played
totally.
It? Or?
The presentation, I think everybody always puts lofty expectations on it. Direct. I think in this one, in terms of like it's 10 minutes long, it's bite size, it's sort of them just being like, here's all the cool stuff that you can play on Switch. I thought that was great, great messaging. But again, looking at a lot of it at surface level, it was a lot of sort of like 8-bit, 16-bit pixely games and stuff like that. And those all seemed to bleed into each other. And then we got to this event and I started playing them. And some of them specifically just completely blew me away. And I know that sounds like, you know, it's just stupid video game journalist speak.
Movie poster line. Yeah. Brian O'Ton was blown away.
But really, I wanted to talk first. Should we talk? You want to talk about Travis Strikes Again?
Yeah, you go.
Talk about,
let's just go in order. You go first.
So right then, let's Travis Strikes Again, No More Heroes. Obviously, it's not the sort of No More Heroes 3 you're expecting. It's a spiritual successor to that, developed by Suda51 and Grasshopper. Suda was on Up at Noon this week in the studio, so check that out. And I got to play with him split screen with two Joy-Cons, which is
super jealous. I played too, but I played all by myself.
Oh,
did
man.
Not get to
really?
Play with Suda.
I could have looked that up.
How is it though?
So it's really fun. We only played one of the games so far, and it's sort of like a hack and slash beat 'em up style game where two characters are running through this kind of glitchy matrixy hallway and using different special attacks to beat up bad guys. You fight waves of enemies and then a boss, and then you team up together and beat him. And it's like it's not nearly as deep as something like even some of the combat in the No More Heroes games, but I found it really fun knowing that this is just one of the many, many games that are going to be in this collection.
So it's like a total variety game.
Yes.
Like, yeah. You know, not WarioWare small, but like smaller kind of segments.
Yep.
I assume kind of varying quality. And
yeah, and it had that thing levels. Too where you have your beam katana, which is your lightsaber, and it runs out of juice, and then you click in the stick and start shaking it, and both of you look very goofy doing that. And it's pretty and it's fun, and it's like it doesn't look like anything else on Switch, so you can see it here if you're watching the video.
It feels a little bit to me like Fury, but with like actual like enemy encounters in between the boss fights, because there are bosses in this game too, which are really interesting. But yeah, like what Brian was saying, like the main mechanic itself is like the beam katana, and you're going through hacking and slashing with enemies. You can play with single Joy-Con, right?
Yeah, and so each one of the face buttons works as a different attack, and then hitting it with another button lets you do like a special version of that attack. And then you can use the shoulder buttons too. So it's getting a lot out of the Joy-Cons, which is pretty smart. And the art's cool and the music's really great, and it doesn't really look like anything else on Switch. Obviously, again, it's not No More Heroes 3, but I want to see how this thing pans out as a full collection. Because
this is very Twilight Princess there.
I know.
Weird glitches
and all the bloominess.
The fences.
Yep.
It's really cool too is throughout the game, Travis, you can actually switch his shirt. And he wears like the logos from different indie games.
He's rocking a Hyper Light Drifter shirt at some point, which is really cool. When I met Suda at PAX last year, I gave him a Shovel Knight pin for his jacket because they're working with those guys in some connections. So that's the cool thing about this. It's sort of a love letter to indie games and kind of a mixtape of a bunch of indie games as well. There's a Hotline Miami themed section. So I'm really interested to see how it all pans out. Apparently, it just works all into one continuous story. So Travis is basically jumping inside games within a game. Suda's always been a big fan of like games that you can play inside other games, which is if you look at something like Geometry Wars, that's basically how that started.
Yep.
So yeah, let's see how this pans out. It'll be out this year. I can't wait to play it.
Very cool.
You didn't get to go to that presentation, Brian, did you?
I didn't. No, yeah. I've been in meetings all the time. But I got to say, I love the aesthetics of this game.
Yeah.
It's really fluid and beautiful.
It's a wacky series for sure.
And then you played The Messenger.
The Messenger.
Well.
Okay. Yeah. So I have to gush about this real quick because this might be my favorite video game demo I've ever taken at
Whoa.
An event.
Oh, wow.
What?
And again, I sat down thinking this is a very straightforward 8-bit style game. Takes a lot of cues from stuff like Ninja Gaiden, like the original NES versions. If you look at it here, it's a pretty straightforward game.
It looks like Ninja Gaiden. Right?
Yeah, it's a simple hack and slash game. Where this game gets deep is that you are a messenger and you are given a scroll that you have to bring to the end of this game. If you're just running through the game, you'll have a good time playing it. But there's also this thing called cloud kicking or cloud jumping, which is basically this double jump that you get from slashing enemies or things in the environment. So speedrunners are going to really latch onto that because it's super cool. When you get to the end of this game, the guy you bring it to is basically like, did you take a look at the scroll you've been carrying? And you go, no. And you open it up And you realize it's a map for the game, and the entire game is now a Metroidvania. It loops back to the beginning of the game where it takes place 30 years later from where you started, and it's all 16-bit now. And now,
oh, so literally they advance the clock on the graphics?
So, yes, they advance the clock on the graphics. So the first level that you're playing is a forest, and 30 years later it's a 16-bit forest that now has a Japanese soldier encampment there. So the environments have changed, right? But certain portals and areas have opened up to reveal the past. So you can jump through the future and the past, aka 8-bit and 16-bit, to solve puzzles, find areas like a tree that used to be there 30 years ago is gone now, and you can reveal it by jumping through a portal.
So like Link to the Past, like two worlds kind of setup.
And so I'm really thinking, like, to me, this really feels like this year's Shovel Knight. It's got, first of all, this boss is just big, big, gross enemy.
I know that guy.
Yeah. So it's got nods to a bunch of NES games and classic vintage retro games, but without being overbearing about them. Like, there's an underwater sections in the game that remind me of the Ninja Turtles underwater sections in the original Ninja Turtles game, but without any of the timers or bombs. The overworld map looks like Ghouls and Ghosts or Ghosts and Goblins, you know, so you have that sort of like scrolling. Really, really, really into this game. It's got like sort of all these different elements that you can kind of like upgrade and different weapons and powers and stuff like that. So I can't wait to see how this pans out. I think it's going to be fun for people who just want to fly through it. I think it's going to be crazy for speedrunners.
Yeah.
Please, please, please keep watching this game and don't just write it off as another 8-bit platforming game.
That's the problem. Like, a lot of games now choose this aesthetic because it's easier to start with something, you know, 8-bit, simple pixel graphics. But then sometimes these games surprise us. And
the thing is also, I mean, like, you see that from afar, right? Or if you walk past it, you judge it immediately, right?
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, okay, I understand what kind of game that is. How long did you get to play with it?
I played it for about 25 minutes. Like, honestly, it was supposed to be like, I kept being like, I'll pass the controller to someone else. And the developers were like, no, we have to show you more. Like, there's more and more and more to show you.
By the way, Little Birds told me that you guys were the last ones to leave and that Nintendo was trying to get you out and you weren't.
They kicked me out. Yeah. At the very end. Yeah. Lily and I stayed there till the very end and then we were both removed.
Yep. NVC shuts down the club. That's how it works.
Yep. Exactly. I also got a chance to play a game called Garage, which is a very, very interesting game. Now, initially looking at this game, it looks very reminiscent to like Smash TV. It's a top-down twin-stick shooter. So it's set in like this zombie apocalypse world, and it's very grimy. It's a dark game, and there's like this natural like CRT line thing going on over the screen, cool. It looks like it comes off sort of just by looking at it as a fast-paced shooting, like running through levels type of game, but it's really actually slower and you have to be strategic while you're playing this game. I wouldn't call this like a Resident Evil game, but it definitely feels like it takes elements from that series and it uses them well.
Do you move the crosshairs yourself or like because the crosshairs go all over the place?
So straight up a twin stick shooter,
but not distance. You just move it left and right.
You can just move it around.
Get faster with distance,
right? Exactly. It does play with like, you know, both sticks. It's a twin stick shooter, but like there's melee weapons in the game and the weapons all react very differently. Ammo is incredibly scarce in this game, so in the demo they gave me a huge surplus of ammo because they obviously wanted us to complete it. Mm-hmm. But they said in the final build of the game that you're actually going to be saving your bullets for when you need it. Like, you'll be using a lot of melee weapons. There's an axe, and it feels really good when you connect with the enemies.
Yeah. It's got this weird fog of war effect, huh? When you're behind a wall, it like blocks out.
Yeah, there's line of sight.
Yeah.
Really stuff. Cool.
Like almost like a tabletop game. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's really cool.
I like this sort of like traditional survival horror elements that have been folded into what is kind of a Smash TV style game. It reminds me of a really good version of Resident Evil Gaiden, which came to the Game Boy, which was a top-down Resident Evil game.
Oh, yeah. I remember. Yeah.
That most of you should forget because it was not good.
Interesting. This is a fun game. I believe it's coming out a little bit sooner. I think May 11th.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so it's just around the corner. So keep your eye out on that if you're a survival horror fan and you like indie games. But another game that we got a chance to play, I don't know if you played it, Brian.
I did not. No.
Lightfall is also coming to Nintendo Switch. Now, this game is for all you speedrunners out there as well. If you enjoyed Celeste, if you liked that style of gameplay where it's a lot of restarting, a lot of like trying to, you know, do the stage over again or get that perfect run, then this is definitely a game you have to keep your eyes on. It brings in some interesting mechanics, though, where, like, in, let's say, a game like Celeste, you had the ability to sort of hyper dodge or, like, you know, boost up to different areas. Well, the mechanic in this game is you can create platforms under you, or you can create them on the side and sort of just grab onto them in midair. But the sort of trick is you can only create four while you're in the air at a time, and then you have to touch the ground to actually reset it. So, like, you can essentially create your own pathways. There's no real route for you to take. Sure, it's usually either left or right, but the verticality in this game is really what makes it very interesting. You can essentially just play it the way you want. And there's boss fights, too, at the very end of a lot of these levels. I don't know if every level has one, but the one that I got a chance to play, I could not finish. I tried so many times. It was very difficult. And the boss fights just act out like very intense speed runs, essentially.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So you're constantly trying to chase the clock, and you can, there's online leaderboards as well that you can, like, upload your score and compete with friends. So I'm really curious to see where the game goes story-wise. The story itself seems, like, pretty interesting. There is a story, definitely, and there's lore in this world. And I think the block itself, they call it a shadow core. So, like, everything has a name for it. The character even has a name, too. I totally forgot it off the top of my head. But, yeah, it's just a very, very cool, smaller game.
So for people listening to the show, I like art style, like a little bit like Patapon or something, right? Like,
yes.
Kind of like
yes.
Shadow style graphics.
Yep. Right.
Oh, is it like the flies or something that is – what is that?
Oh, yeah.
It's like following him. There's all these little dust.
It's like
speckles.
These little pixie things. Yeah.
Is
I'm
it
not
part of the gameplay or?
No, they don't really interact with the character, but it looks like it's emitting off of him. I actually didn't even notice that until you pointed it out. I was just so busy. Yeah.
I wonder if that is some sort of power or the.
Yeah.
Maybe they create the blocks.
Yeah.
Yeah, this looks fun.
Brian, did you get to play a lot of like Switch other indies? Do you guys have time as a dev team to ever like look at what the other guys are doing?
The thing is, like, I've got a pretty big family and stuff. Yeah. And so I never get to use my TV for one, like in the living room. And
Switch has a solution for that, no?
It does, but I've only been playing like Mario Odyssey, actually, and then just very much bits and pieces. Like for me, it's much easier and much more relaxing to just talk to the guys and girls in the office because they play so much.
Yeah, yeah.
And they always come up with really good sort of they can sort of pinpoint things immediately. It's like, this is really cool.
Blah, 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 blah. Yeah,
instead of like wasting time. That's amazingly rude to say that.
Yeah.
But like, they do the research.
Right? Oh, that's awesome.
And I'm working next to, Julius, who is our community manager at Image Forum, he's just encyclopedic, right? You can ask him anything. He'll have dates for you. 30,
that's awesome.
30, 40 years back.
Yeah. Very cool. I got one more game I want to talk about before we move on to the last segment of the show. And
is it Bomb Chicken?
It can be, I guess.
Oh, which one did you want?
All right, we got two more games to talk about. Let's talk about Bomb Chicken first.
All right, Bomb Chicken real quick. I really, really, really like this game. You're a chicken that lays eggs that are bombs.
I could tell that you would like this.
Yeah.
I saw it in the presentation.
It is fun.
Yeah, and I thought it'd be Bomberman-ish, but it's a side-scrolling platforming game. You have this pudgy little chicken, and he's so great. And you kind of have an endless stack of bombs. The bombs can kill you, which is interesting, because it's weird to lay eggs that can kill you. But you can kick them as weapons. You can climb on them as platforms. You can use them to trigger buttons and icons and open up, you know, environments and areas and levels. And basically, it's your end all be all. You also fight enemies with them just by running up, leaving a stack. And then, and so every now and then, these doors ask you for a bunch of money. And using all the money you get, you feed them into the doors and you open up new areas. It's super clever. It's really fun. The art's great. I like this game a lot, and I can't wait to play more of it.
When I first I thought it was an R2 game, like something like Jules made, you know?
It sounds like the art style and everything.
And he loves chickens.
Yep, he does love
chickens. He does, yeah. Yeah, he's doing the chicken wiggle Kickstarter right now.
That's true.
I will say the gameplay itself seems very simple, and it is in action as well, but it's so fun to run around as this chicken just laying bombs and blowing stuff up.
It's a very Nintendo thing to do, to take a simple, goofy mechanic like this and then stretch it out to a million different directions and kind of see how many different ways you can use it.
Yeah.
And so I really like that about this game.
I love the look and animation.
Yeah.
It's just really cute.
You're good to go.
Yes. If you love the look and animation of this game, well, then you're going to be very surprised about this next game, because the next one is Just Shapes and Beats. Figured. Yes. Yeah. It's a little bit it's a simple looking game from the graphics perspective, but the gameplay here is incredibly fun. I got a chance to play this with three other people, so we had like four people on screen. You're looking at the gameplay that I recorded with two people, though. And so what this is it's essentially a bullet hell rhythm game.
What?
So you're constantly trying to avoid things, but it's the soundtrack of this game that really, really picks it up, because the things that are happening on screen are totally in sync with the music. And so you're sort of like dodging this stuff to a certain rhythm that is very, very, I don't know, it's very hard to describe, but it really gets your heart racing and it gets very intense and very hard. So what's cool is you definitely want to play this game with another person, because you're going to probably die a lot like I did in my demo with it. And it's really easy to like revive your friends and stuff.
Oh, cool. I didn't realize you could do that.
And like, I think during the presentation I saw there were like side-scrolling stages where it's like a little ship jumping over stuff. So it has different types of
There's like a world map, which is really interesting. So like this is just like a level that's happening inside of the game. And it is actually moving like from side to side, you can see.
Wow.
So you're constantly having to dodge stuff that's, you know, sometimes coming out of the center of the screen and stuff that's coming from the sides. But the level itself is constantly moving in motion. And then when you complete each level, you go back to the overworld, and then there are these really weird parts where you have to get into a boat, and then you can actually control the boat, and there's this little music thing there that happens. It's a very interesting game, very fun party game. Definitely keep your eye on this one if you're looking for a good party game to play with your friends. I really enjoyed my time with it. And
this looks so mean.
Yeah. It's brutal.
It's so hard.
So in terms of a rhythm game, is that happening without your input, or are you tapping along with the rhythm, or is it just sort of like the soundtrack is defining the enemy patterns?
It's kind of like, you remember those old screensavers on computers that would like sync to music, or like Xbox,
like Winamp visualizers, like basically?
Winamp visualizer. That's what this is.
Sweet.
It's Winamp visualizer, the video game, but with really good
only
music.
90s kids would
so the music
those.
Tells you dodge now.
Yeah.
Yes.
I love that.
You can anticipate the big things that are coming, like the big hits, like especially once you learn the songs. And I can totally like take my word for it. The music is really, really good. It's some of the artists are, if you're familiar with like chiptune artists, Cubby is featured in the soundtrack, and I know he's a very, very popular chiptune artist. So things like that are really cool and compelling about
there's something like very Fantasia about all of this.
Yeah.
Oh, like the I remember.
Yeah. Like was, this is one of those games where, if I looked at it.
Lights of Spring or something that did something like
that. Yeah. When you look at this game at first glance, I was like, yeah, this is a just kind of simplistic, you know, it's like just like your typical sort of like one developer indie game. And then it keeps going and going and going, and I can't look away. It's awesome.
Yeah.
I'm really excited to play this one.
Very fun.
And that guy kind of looks like Pac-Man.
Yeah, but those are just a few of the games that we got a chance to go hands-on with at GDC from the Nindies Showcase this week. Thank you very much, Brian Altano, for joining us. Zach is going to swap in, and he's going to tell us a little bit about something special happening this week regarding Wind Waker.
Zach Attack.
Thanks for having me. See you guys soon. Bye, Brajan.
Bye, Brajan.
Here we go. And welcome back to part two of NVC, and we're joined by Zachary Ryan.
I'm back.
Here to tell us a little bit about the Wind Waker.
Yeah, so an interesting opportunity presented itself this week. This week, this Saturday, marks the 15th anniversary of the original North American release of The Legend of Zelda: The Wind Waker. Those of you that are fans of the show know that it's my personal favorite game of all time, and I thought that this would be sort of a great impetus to start something that I've been kind of kicking around with you guys for a while, kind of looking back at big Nintendo releases for each week of that week, right? So March 24th marks the release of the 15-year anniversary of The Legend of Zelda. So I've got a little bit of a history lesson, and then I kind of want to talk about what we thought about the game at the time, what we think about it now. Try to keep it tight, but let's jump in here. So this is the eighth game of the Legend of Zelda series, and I'm not counting Four Swords Adventures in this case. Come at me if you have to. Released in North America on March 24th, 2003, 3 months after the Japanese release. Back then, Matt Casmasina, close personal friend of Pear, gave the game a 9.6 and saying, "The Wind Waker is a masterful achievement, a shining example, in fact, of how video games should be made, and a case study for developers wondering what makes a compelling game." So you know, yeah, maybe right. take some notes
yeah.
there.
Exactly. Better learn.
So a lot of the history stuff that I'm going to give you guys right now is coming from the story of the Wind Waker by Keza MacDonald, former IGN staffer currently at Kotaku. She wrote this piece back around the time of the Wind Waker HD's release. Mm-hmm. And then also there's a really great Iwata Asks. Are you familiar with the Iwata Asks platform?
No.
Yeah. So Iwata Asks is this awesome sort of questionnaire that Mr. Iwata used to do to IGN staff, to Nintendo staff, mm-hmm. To kind of deep dive into games. And there's some really awesome like development and programming and art design notes that come out of these things. So a lot of that stuff is coming from here.
Cool.
So real quickly, Personnel, directed by Eiji Onuma. So, father of modern Zelda games. Produced by Miyamoto and Takashi Tezuka. Mm-hmm. Written by Matsuhiro Takano, who did Star Fox 64 and Majora's Mask. And Hajime Takahashi, who actually worked on Pikmin and Luigi's Mansion. So, an interesting kind of take on the story by guys that worked on games that weren't super story-centric, right?
Yep.
And then, of course, music by Koji Kondo. And a whole staff of Nintendo composers. I think there were six other composers on this game. Koji Kondo famously writes, "Where's the Jumpy?"
Where's the Jumpy?
Pear's favorite song
Where's the Jumpy?
Yeah, Pear loves that song. So the production for Wind Waker actually began back before Majora's Mask shipped. And it was originally planned to have a really similar style to those games, like sort of that dark kind of mature look. And
it's the demo we saw.
Right. And so it famously sort of made its debut at Space World in 2000. Mm. Pear, can you tell us a little bit about
Space World? I saw that in person. Yeah, I was at Space World. Space World was this expo that Nintendo did, basically their own show, like a mini Tokyo game show just for
Nintendo
games.
So here it is now if you're watching.
If you're watching it, you can see this demo. And like it looks cheesy now, but we were like, oh my God, if the next Zelda game looks like this,
right.
we're all in. This is all we ever wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that's not what we got in the end. And like, and that initial kind of, you know, like when we actually got to see this game, there was a big reaction. But this is what we first saw at the event, and we loved it.
Oh, so I didn't know you were there.
Pre-rendered wave ray stuff, and all
I didn't know you were there like in person.
Yeah,
you saw it.
Yeah,
okay, that's really cool.
It was an awesome moment to like see what we thought would become the GameCube Zelda like that, and you're like, oh my God,
right?
You know,
well, and eventually we got that with Twilight Princess, that sort of return to the more mature and dark look in a Zelda game. Aonuma famously hated this demo. He said, there's a quote from that Iwata asked that said, "The video clip didn't actually contain any big surprises. There wasn't any kind of revelation going on. It was more like a continuation of the previous version." So this is interesting because Pear, I feel like, is saying that that's what fans were looking for, is this sort of continuation.
Yeah.
But according to Nintendo, but according to Nintendo, not different enough from previous Zelda
excursions.
Well,
you have to remember, like, when Majora's Mask came out, the N64 and the engine used was showing its age. Majora's Mask did not run well, right? Mm-hmm. They took the Ocarina of Time engine. They created this much kind of like bigger open world centered around that center, the city in the center. And like it chugged and it didn't always look beautiful. And it was very flickery.
Mm-hmm.
It looks better on 3DS now.
Yeah.
And so we were saying, oh man, if they can just use this kind of like dark tone and more mature style from Ocarina of Time with Grown Up Link on the GameCube with these beautiful graphics, we're going to lose our minds. It wasn't like, hey, let's get this exact same game again, because Majora's Mask was already so different.
Yeah.
But we wanted that like evolution in graphics.
But we would come to find that Zelda would follow that same sort of formula for the next few games, right? So it was around the time that Aonuma was kicking this idea around that production shifted, thanks in part to Yoshiki Hirahana and Satoru Takazawa. I'm sorry, Takazawa. I know I'm butchering
Takizawa.
These names.
No, you got
are
it.
You are you just cringing over there?
I no, feel like
you're.
It's all
right.
Good.
Thank you.
It's beautiful.
So these two gentlemen presented Aonuma with early drawings of tune versions of Link and other Hyrule inhabitants. In fact, I have those drawings. If Andres wants to bring those up here, you can see the original sketches that they did. So there's, you know, tune Link and a Moblin. A Moblin?
Yeah, that's a Moblin.
These are the initial images that were presented to Aonuma-san that said, like, hey, this is the direction that we're thinking about going.
I mean, super close to what we got.
Yeah.
Especially the Moblin design that is basically it. Whereas, like, Link, they definitely tweaked the eyes. Of course, nowadays, if people had seen this character, everybody would have said, Link is a girl. It's confirmed, right?
Right. Is he not a girl? I thought Link was the girl the whole time.
No, that's Metroid.
Oh, my bad.
But it's kind of close, though, right? I mean,
very close.
Yeah.
It's not far away.
Yeah. Hair and the crazy dangly sideburns, everything.
So one of the gentleman who drew these images, Hirohana, he credits a lot of this look to his mentor, Yoichi Kotabe, who we know did a lot of box art and instruction manual illustrations for Nintendo. Famously, he did the designs for Super Mario Brothers 3, Super Mario World. That's all Kotabe's work.
Oh, okay.
But before he was at Nintendo, he worked at Toei, which is a Japanese animation company. Right. You familiar with Toei?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Specifically, he worked on a film in the 60s called The Little Prince and the Eight-Headed Dragon, which, if we want to roll that B-roll here, if you're watching at home, you can see this trailer for this film from 1963, which is just dead on looking just like the Wind Waker.
It's awesome when you see the expressions on the character close up, like just the face and the, you know, the, look at the eyebrows and right. everything. It's so Wind Waker looking.
And it's such an interesting,
or the other way around.
Like, it's such an interesting look because this is such a time and a place for animated films from Japan. Like 60s and 70s, a lot of anime looked like this.
Mm-hmm.
And then they sort of got away to the more familiar stuff that we know today. But this is a very distinct look. And I think, like, even the fire and stuff is very representative of what you would see in Wind Waker. So a lot of Toei animation borrowed for the Wind Waker's design, but a lot of people specifically point to this film, and I think it's pretty easy to understand why when you're looking at it in motion.
Yeah. It's beautiful.
Yeah. It's really, really cool. If you haven't seen it, I highly recommend watching. It's a really interesting sort of series of vignettes. It's a cool, cool film. So eventually the game was re-revealed the following year at Space World as the Wind Waker.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to run some footage here that it's sort of the only existing footage that we've got. It's shot off screen. But this was the original reveal, and oh boy, people were pissed. sort of infamously dubbed Zelda. Zelda fans were very angry that their more mature, dark version of Link, like in Ocarina of Time and Majora's Mask, wasn't being represented on this new powerful hardware. But you know, ultimately, this like Saturday morning cartoon look has sort of won out and stood the test of time. Which is, it's interesting to have you on this segment because I feel like a lot of image and form games have borrowed a cel shaded look, and the conversation around cel shading is that it represents a kind of timeless look. Like,
yeah.
SteamWorld Dig 2 will look just as amazing as it does in 15, 20 years. As it does right now, and that's the same case with Zelda.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about why you guys chose that sort of art style for SteamWorld?
Well, the thing was that for the first one, there is a difference. I mean, it'd be hard for Andres to pull it up on the screen right
sure.
now. But like for the first one, SteamWorld Dig, we use like pretty heavy outlines for the characters.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of like sets them apart from the backgrounds and so on. It's sort of like an easy way to... This is the character. This is the environment that you're moving around in. even when we started with SteamWorld Heist, the first drawings that we had were actually sort of like cel shaded. It was no outlines. Sort of you see this character standing by itself, and I didn't like it.
Oh,
yeah, it was a tough moment too,
yeah.
Because like. if you trust your designers enough, right, to say that I trust you guys, you like it's going to look beautiful. This is going to work beautiful. This is going to sound beautiful, etc. And then you start sort of, yeah, but can we change this and this and this? It's really hard for staff to sort of ignore it completely.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, yeah, whatever, Grandpa. It's like we're not going to do it that way.
Well, I mean, I imagine this happened with this game,
yeah.
But the audience was giving the feedback, right?
Yeah.
Like the feedback when Link was revealed and was more childlike with big like googly eyes and like doing the cartoon like running in the air and falling thing, like people were so angry.
Yeah.
They were so angry. And so I remember that the development team was like, why are they not clapping, right? Like there was this kind of like this moment where the design team was – I'm sure thinking, did we make a huge mistake too, right?
But also, I mean, like it's like the characters, Zelda, like you said, it's like the eighth game in the series. The character doesn't really belong to Nintendo anymore. It's like it belongs to the players.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they grow up with this. I mean, eight games, like it's a fair chunk of time.
Right? Yeah.
So you have grown accustomed to it. and you demand that it's
perfect. It's what you remember.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah, it's supposed to look like.
And I think that there's some sort of like weird disconnect between the narrative and the gaps that your brain fills in when you're playing those earlier Zelda games versus what the actual concept art looks like and stuff. Because in a lot of gamers' minds, like mine included, like when I think about the fantasy world of Zelda, it's sort of a dark fantasy, you know, right. especially like Zelda 2 and Ocarina of Time, Majora's Mask. But if you go back and look at the concept art for the original Zelda, he's just this like pudgy little
the box
elf
art too,
you know?
Right? Like it's a little chunky dude, and like, he actually looks closest to Wind Waker.
Right, he looks So I think it's interesting that people were so up in arms. Like, you were obviously in the industry at the time. What were your thoughts
on first reaction was like, what? Like, I was shocked. Mm-hmm. I was like, but aren't they trying to get a more mature gaming audience, right? Sure. Like, I was really surprised, and then it grew on me. But but the initial reaction was, oh no, what have they done? Like, I wanted that fight. In my mind, that fight looked a lot better than it looks now.
Right.
Right? And so you're like, wait till Ganon turns into the giant pig. It'll be so cool, right? Ganondorf.
Sure.
And then you're presented with this cartoon. I'm like, oh, I didn't want that. And then as I kept rewatching it, I'm like, oh man, look, those trees look like the trees from A Link to the Past. Mm-hmm. And Link looks like the original kind of Link from the concept, from the box art. And so it kind of grows on you. But there was a big contingent of the audience that was vehemently opposed to it, who were pissed and said they wouldn't buy this.
Right.
That's the thing. I mean, like, especially visually, people reject change. I mean, we don't want things to change. Like, whenever like a company changes their logo, for example, or like a product starts looking different, there's always like a violent reaction to it, and then you grow accustomed to it. And like today, I mean, nobody is really talking about this as a huge.
It's still not making people angry, is what you're saying, right?
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. So, like, as a 16-year-old animation dork in high school, when I saw this reveal, I was all in from the get-go. You know, like, being a Saturday morning cartoon guy and seeing this, how fluidly it ran, was just like, oh, this is amazing. Like, this
Played Ocarina of Time before?
So that's actually an interesting thing, because Wind Waker, the visual style of Wind Waker, was the sort of impetus for getting me into Zelda. I had played A Link's Awakening 100 years prior, and really enjoyed that, but this game got me so excited to play a Zelda game that I ended up going back and playing Ocarina, Majora, and Link to the Past sort of back to back.
That's the key difference. Yeah. Like, people, you know, the character had evolved in people's minds, and so suddenly we got this like record scratch, go back to the beginning.
I bet you're wondering how we got here.
Yeah. I remember being like, I think I was 10 years old maybe, when that original like GameCube demo of the more realistic Link, more mature Link came out. And I remember actually seeing Wind Waker and feeling opposite of how you felt, Zach, like just disappointed, more like,
oh, really?
And I was only like 10 years old. I wanted that more mature look. But lo and behold, after playing it, it ended up being one of the most like emotional experiences I've had in video games. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think we're covering we're going to spoil anything for anyone out there.
It's a 15-year-old game. If you haven't played it by now, I mean.
But like when you get to like Hyrule Castle for the first time and you sort of like realize like what's going on.
To
like,
me, we did a list of top moments in gaming and last year. And that was one of my most favorite moments in all of gaming. When you pull the sword out and the color spreads throughout the castle, like such a cool moment.
Totally.
To do a frozen in time place.
Yeah,
in
so
black
cool.
and white was so cool.
Yeah.
Too.
So the game eventually ships in 2002 in Japan, 2003 in the States. It was at that time the GameCube was not performing super hot, and the general rumor is that this game and Super Mario Sunshine were sort of rushed out the gate because Nintendo was saying things like, "Hey, we need to have two heavy hitters on this platform because right now it's not selling super well." And as a result of that, so it wound up this game got cut quite a bit. We lost two full dungeons that actually ended up in later Zelda games, and instead they replaced those dungeons with the Triforce quest, which is terrible and bad.
In the original, so if you play the remake, it actually got fixed.
Right.
Like it got changed.
Yeah.
The original was a little bit like the game almost ground to a halt if you hadn't taken some of those side quests before then or found some of the pieces. It became a chore.
You're just grinding for rupees and trying to track down Tingle's maps and stuff like that. And I think that the HD version that came out, you know, several years later, really made that a lot more succinct and fixed a lot of those issues.
And fixed the travel element.
Fixed the sailing.
So you can
do
fast travel. Yep.
We talked a little bit about the look and what we liked about it, but I also wanted to mention a couple of things that I really dug about this game, and kind of get your opinion, the revamped combat in Wind Waker, the idea of a parry that allowed you to flip around behind enemies or use the grappling hook to steal things from enemies that were coming at you. I thought that was really interesting.
It's a quick time event done right. Mm-hmm. Like when you're getting attacked and you're waiting, you're leaving yourself out open, the A button flashes, right? It gets that little the starburst around it. If you hit it at the right time, he'll roll around the enemy. When you're locked on,
right,
rolls around the enemy and slashes the enemy from the end. It feels really satisfying.
Yeah.
It just feels really good. And then later it becomes a gameplay element where you have enemies
when
who
you're
are
taking
armored
on
from the
dark
front,
nuts, yeah,
but they got little leather straps on the back, so you roll around, go chick, cut, and then the armor falls off.
Right.
Like that was a really good combat system. And the flip over the top
right,
too, and
to take off the helmets and yep, things like that. I think it's also probably the most cheerful post-apocalypse we've ever seen.
Yeah.
I actually I feel like SteamWorld Dig is also sort of a cheerful post-apocalypse.
Yeah. Right.
And this game is very similar in the same way in that there's been this catastrophic event, but people aren't necessarily bummed out about it.
Right.
You know, it's enough time has passed that they're sort of
getting
on with life.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's like in your world, like the robots are cool with it, right?
Yeah, they're totally fine with it. I mean, and they probably weren't sad at any point, right?
Right.
It's,
they're robots.
Yeah, they're robots.
I feel like sorrow is programmed into some of those robots in your game for sure.
Yeah, well, yeah, they have a little bit of sorrow or yearning and stuff.
But so not over the ability to kind of be the dominant race.
No, exactly. Yeah. That's sort of, they're not wired for that.
Right.
My robot felt sorrow whenever my bag was full and all these diamonds popped out.
Right.
Yeah, thank you very much for that.
That's when my robot felt the most sorrow as well.
Digital tears everywhere.
The last thing that I want to talk about before we kind of close up shop, and I'm sorry, I know we've already gone over here, but this game... very closely connected to Ocarina of Time, narratively. Sort of the first game to acknowledge that other Zelda games had come before it and kind of kicked off this idea of... I know that you're familiar with this too, I'm sure. The timeline theories and the multiple timelines and this sort of debate about what Zelda games happen when and the kind of thing that makes Miyamoto-san roll his eyes but gets like Zelda geeks like myself and Philip, you know, talking about like, oh, where does this fall in the timeline?
That is so cool.
And it's a curveball in this game because you didn't expect Wind Waker to connect to Ocarina because the art styles are so different, mm-hmm, right? You're expecting this to be a standalone game. First of all, mechanics-wise, it's the only game at that point with a boat where you like travel around, whereas like Ocarina and Majora, Ocarina had all this horse stuff in it. Mm-hmm. Majora had all the kind of...
King of Red Lions,
turning into different characters like a Goron. And so this game felt like a new story, a different story. And then you find Hyrule Castle, you're like... It's all there.
It's all the same.
The legends are real.
Yeah.
You bastard.
Yeah. So obviously the big question here is since the HD remaster came out in 2013 for Wii U, when will we see it on Switch? Would you guys be interested in having a Switch version to take on the road? I feel like that's probably a silly question to ask to this crowd. not to put you on blast here, but if it comes to Switch, will this finally be the opportunity for you to play Wind Waker all the way through and come back on the show and talk to us about it?
Yeah. Yeah, and then we'll do a full sort of review of that.
Perfect.
So,
great.
So yeah, before you share, before you joined, he said, you know,
he's telling us off camera that he hasn't had an opportunity yet.
Taken over by his family.
Yeah.
And so with the Switch, you can actually play games when the kids are taking over the big screen.
Yeah.
But so I actually, because I replayed it when it came back out, I feel like it's very fresh in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I would not go back to this. Well, I would love for Nintendo to go back to like Super Mario Sunshine or some of those games that aren't as highly played first.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, I want all, like GameCube had all these amazing games that look really, really good on the small screen.
Yeah.
I want them all. Like, just bring them back.
Not me, sister. Yeah. I just want Wind Waker. So, yeah.
You really, but
it's a game that you didn't play recently? I played it when the HD remaster came out. And I'll tell you, I've played this game top to bottom, I think probably more times through than I've played any other game, and I've definitely played it more than I've played any other Zelda game. It is my favorite game, and it's because it's the most charming, most personable version of Zelda that I think exists.
And it's the first game where each weapon had a really unique trait to it, right?
That's true, too. Yeah.
The hammer did different things to the enemies than mm-hmm. the sword. And, like, the swinging of the rope, you could steal things from your opponent.
You could steal enemies,
yeah,
you know? or steal weapons from enemies, I mean. Yeah.
No, it's an amazing game. I love that.
But you don't want to play it again.
No, cool. I just want to play other things first. I want to play SteamWorld Dig 3 first.
Yeah. I mean, there, you know,
I'll play that as well.
Work on it.
There were plenty of people that did not buy a Wii U that did not get a chance to play Wind Waker HD.
Yeah. Right.
I'm not going to name names.
Switch,
but
please don't name any names.
But you guys have done some re-releases too, right? Like SteamWorld Heist, for example, and SteamWorld Dig 1 are available on Switch.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that. I mean, like, we, for us, it was when we got the dev kit for the NX back then. I mean, it was it was before that meeting, or they had a word for it. It's like we were being disclosed.
Yeah,
that was the word. Yeah, and before we sat in a cafeteria nervously with a cup of coffee, talking to a Nintendo guy that we know, and I was sort of asking, so in which order should we do this? Like, wouldn't it be best if we bring SteamWorld Dig to the Switch first?
Yeah.
And they said, it's probably better if we go with new content because that's how we're going to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I agreed with that. I thought it was really good. And also gave us sort of an opportunity to to blow it open for ourselves. Like, here comes Dig 2. It's a fantastic game on the Switch. If you like that game, then you should get back and play the older titles.
Sure.
I'm curious to see how Nintendo's going to do, because the Switch is such a success, right?
Yeah.
What if they would just bring back all, like catalog games?
Yeah.
Well, they did Bayonetta 2 and 1.
Sure. Yeah, yeah, that's happened.
And, like, it could have, like, they didn't wait for Bayonetta 3 to come out, so, you know, they did it the other way around.
That's true. Yeah. Some learnings there, but, I mean, I'm personally glad that Dig 2 came to Switch first, because I hadn't had an opportunity to play the other SteamWorld games.
Right.
And so I played through SteamWorld Dig 2. I immediately started over and played through it again. And then when 1 and Heist came to Switch, I played those as well. So it totally introduced me. You know, like, I think in that case, they made the right call, because it introduced me to a franchise that I wasn't familiar with, with a game that totally blew me away, and then allowed me to go back and be like, oh, here's what I've missed. Right. So, yeah.
Also, that's sort of like what you use Nintendo for, right? They they think about these things.
Sure.
It's like, yeah, Brian, very interesting idea, but let's do it this way.
Yeah,
totally.
Yeah. Right on.
I would take a Zelda collection, though, that includes it.
Ooh.
With some of the older games in it.
What if it was just the Master's Collection from the GameCube that was Zelda 1, 2, Ocarina, Majora's Mask, and then Wind Waker?
And then Wind Waker. Yeah. I would so
take
that.
Could even be a 3D collection that doesn't include Breath of the Wild or something. Like, if they
what about a 3D collection that doesn't include Twilight Princess or Skyward Sword? That'd be fine.
I like Twilight Princess. I enjoyed Skyward Sword.
All right. We can talk about this all day. We've got plenty of time to talk about this. Oh, man. Thank you very much for joining us, Brian.
Thank you very much for having us.
All the way from Sweden.
Yes.
Thank you.
Very cool. And have a great rest of your GDC as well.
Thank you very much.
Cool. And thank you guys for tuning in with us this week. We are a weekly show on IGN.com, but you can also catch us on YouTube.com and your favorite podcast listening services. So definitely make sure you're subscribed if you haven't already, and we will see you next week.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts, with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz, and how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.